From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch.
In 2015, author Daniel James Brown visited Park City to speak to the community when his best-selling book, Boys in the Boat, was chosen as the book for the entire community to read. It captivated readers, and we've all been waiting to see what's next from Daniel James Brown. His new book is Facing the Mountain. It uncovers the seldom-told story of the 422nd Infantry Regiment, an army unit almost entirely made up of second-generation Japanese Americans, and the growing animosity towards Japanese Americans that followed the attack on Pearl Harbor. We think it's a very current story. That's why we invited Daniel James Brown back to Park City on the radio. Daniel, welcome. It's great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Because you came to Park City and you spoke, and I was at that talk in the Jim Santee Auditorium with lots of other people, and it was such a powerful book, Boys in the Boat. I'm just wondering what the research that went into that, the research that went into Facing the Mountain, how do you sink your teeth into these things? How do you find the story?
You know, these are big research projects for me, so I try to take my time. It takes me 4 to 5 years to research and write one of these books. So it took me a long time to settle on this topic. But what happened was in 2015, I ran into a gentleman named Tom Ikeda in Seattle. And Tom has for 25 years been collecting the oral histories of Japanese Americans, videotaping their recollections, curating them, and making them available on his website, densho.org. So I got talking to Tom, and I started watching these oral histories of all these folks he interviewed over the years. And these were all Japanese Americans. I found a lot of stories that just really intrigued me a lot. I'm all about story. That's what gets me going. And I was finding in there these stories, again, about ordinary Americans confronting difficult challenges and pulling together to overcome them. And it began, although it's quite different in many ways, it began to feel in my mind somewhat like The Boys in the Boat in some of its underlying themes. So working with Tom over the next few years and interviewing many, many people, I eventually wound up writing this book that weaves together the stories of four young men, Japanese American men, and their experiences during the war.
So you say that there are some similarities in the story, and I would pick out a couple, being the underdog, coming from behind, having commitment, but also you talk about patriotism. Patriotism, that word is a funny word right now. People have lots of different ideas about what patriotism is. What would you say about that?
That's interesting. I mean, it's really at the heart of what sort of provided the springboard into this book. Right after Pearl Harbor, draft age young men, second generation men, Nisei men, they faced this dilemma. Other young American men were signing up by the millions to serve their country, to go off to war. Many of them wanted to do that too, but they were not allowed to do that because of their ancestry. In the meanwhile, they and their families are being hauled off to these camps and incarcerated in the camps. They're having to walk away from their schools. They're losing their businesses. They're having to sell off all their worldly goods for pennies on the dollar. And so these young men, and this is true, of course, of the young women and all of them, but young men of draft age in particular had to figure out, well, what is it to be an American? What is the patriotic thing for me to do as a Japanese American? And as I say, many of them wanted to enlist in the service, but it was a year before they were allowed to. Others thought the most patriotic thing to do was to resist with all their powers, the incarcerations of their families, and also to resist serving in the military that of the government that had confined their families. So there was a lot of debate, a lot of disagreement about what the patriotic thing to do. And some of these young men wound up deciding to serve ultimately, and others wound up deciding to resist. But both of these were in their minds, the right American thing to do, the patriotic thing to do.
And there's this contrast and this dichotomy of way of thinking for these Japanese Americans, one struggling with the, you know, basically the concentration camps that were created in the U.S. while fighting this other larger cause that democracy was at stake. You share the story of one of the patriots in your story as a resistor. Why did you feel that you needed to include, be inclusive of a resistor as a patriot and not just the soldiers?
Because as I say, it was, there were a lot of young men who resisted and there were a lot who signed up. I chose the young man, that I chose to represent the resistors. His name was Gordon Hirabayashi. And Gordon was a really interesting young man. He was a young man of very strong principles. He actually was a conscientious objector even before World War II began. And he was a Quaker. Gordon, shortly after Pearl Harbor, a curfew, 8 p.m. curfew was imposed on anybody of Japanese descent in the city of Seattle. Gordon, when he discovered that there was this curfew order, originally obeyed it. Then he suddenly realized, why am I having to obey this curfew? None of my classmates at the University of Washington are having to. So Gordon simply stopped obeying the curfew. And in fact, he started documenting in his journal. He kept writing down occasions on which he was deliberately disobeying the curfew. And then when the time came for the Japanese Americans in Seattle to get on buses and be taken off to these camps, Gordon just didn't get on the bus. And instead, he sat down and he wrote out on this long, detailed letter to address to the FBI, explaining in sort of large constitutional terms why he felt that the curfew and the incarceration of Japanese Americans were wrong and unconstitutional. He took that letter and he went downtown Seattle, walked into the FBI offices there, handed them the letter, and turned himself in. And that began a long legal process. Gordon was, first he was held in the King County Jail for many months. Then he was out for a while on parole. Then he was in a work farm prison in Tucson, Arizona. And then finally he wound up in a federal prison for the remainder of the war. But all this while, his legal case worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where actually he lost, and that's a whole thing in itself. But in the long run, he was vindicated. His case was vacated decades later, and actually after he passed away, President Obama awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom for the principled stand he had taken against what had happened to Japanese Americans.
And I just can't think of anything more patriotic than that in a climate in the U.S. where families, hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans were being relocated to concentration camps, and one of the larger ones here in Utah. And, you know, I've been in that area of Delta, and it is not where I'd want my family to move, nor be forced to move and sell everything that we have. And, in your research, did you visit some of these concentration camps? And you also used the term concentration camps intentionally. So share a little bit more about that.
Yes, I did. I try to visit, as many of the, when I'm writing about a place, I try to visit as many of them as I can. It just helps me, paint a scene. It's mostly just little sensory details like what mesquite trees smell like or something. So I did. But the term concentration camp, I'm glad you asked me. I do want to be able to explain that. First of all, I'm in no way equating these camps with the death camps and the slave labor camps of the Nazis. And I think that, you know, since the war, World War II, that association has been there for many people. These camps were not like that. They were very severe. And as you mentioned, they were usually in places you would not want to be. They were cold in the winter and hot in the summer and just generally miserable places to be. But I used the term deliberately because it's not just that term, but at the time that people were incarcerated in these camps by the government used a whole bunch of very euphemistic language, sort of soft peddling what was happening. People were taken first to usually to fairgrounds and places like that where they were kept temporarily in horse barns and places like that. Before they were sent on to these camps out in the desert. The government called those assembly centers. They called these permanent camps relocation centers. They called locking people up internment. And so there was this sort of effort by the government to use the softest possible language they could when talking about what they were actually doing to American citizens. And concentration camp was one of those terms. They definitely did not use that term. But in fact, these were concentration camps. They were designed to concentrate a particular population of people based on their ethnic background, surround them by barbed wire, and isolate them from the rest of the population. Franklin Roosevelt himself used the term concentration camp just before the war. The war has changed, you know, the connotations people have with the term, but technically these were concentration camps, and I felt it was important to use honest language to describe them.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Daniel James Brown. You remember him as the best-selling author of Boys in the Boat. He visited Park City. Now he's back. Maybe he'll visit Park City again. As you said, it's a pretty nice place to visit.
It is.
His new book is Facing the Mountain, A True Story of Japanese American Heroes in World War II. Pete mentioned Topaz, the concentration camp near Delta, Utah. And I haven't been there. Pete has. And I wanted to ask you about that on the Topaz Museum out in Delta, which has been closed due to COVID. But their literature says, if we can understand what occurred and why, we can be more vigilant, making certain a similar denial of civil rights will never happen to any other Americans. And I just thought that I'd ask you to comment on that, especially as we have seen this rise in anti-Asian sentiment in the last year in this country. What do you make of that?
Yeah, one of the things I learned in writing this book is that the anti-Asian sentiment in this country goes way back. It actually goes back to the gold rush in California in 1849. Originally, large numbers of Chinese immigrants came to work in California, either in the gold fields or working on the railroads, Transcontinental Railroad. They were subject to a great deal of violence and racial animus. There were beatings and lynchings and burnings, and people were driven out of their homes. Then in around the turn of the century, there was this notion of the yellow peril, where Asian immigrants were equated with rats and insects and the bringers of disease and all these things. And all those notions sort of got built into the American psyche during that period. When Pearl Harbor happened, all those images and associations and tropes, those all rose instantly to the surface as people were angry about Pearl Harbor. It was already there. These images and these ideas were already there. So they got recycled. And And then I think it's undeniable that they have been, again, sort of surfacing more recently, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years, and even more particularly the last 4 or 5 months, because of COVID. Again, this association with plague and disease was already there, somewhere simmering under the surface in our collective American consciousness. And so it was easy for certain politicians to bring those images and ideas up to the surface and weaponize them again. So it was startling to me as I was researching and writing the book, how many echoes there were between what I was researching and writing about and what was happening during the four and a half years that I was writing it. They just coincided almost perfectly. Originally, the first thing I read about and was writing about were hardworking immigrant families from Japan trying to make their way in this country. And that was, and then the executive order 9066 that incarcerated Japanese Americans. That was right at the time of the previous president's executive order and all this anti-immigrant rhetoric. When families, I was reading about families being torn apart by the incarcerations, was when all these families were being torn apart at the southern border. The book is not intended to be political in any way, but there were these definite echoes between what happened then and what's been happening more recently that, I think readers will see when they read the book.
It's interesting because when we hear the stories of the Japanese Americans in World War II, we think that it's such an atrocity what we did to them, and that could never happen again. But sort of unfathomable that things like this are happening again. And I'm wondering, in the beginning you spoke about Tom Ikeda, who's the executive director of Densho, which is this Seattle-based nonprofit dedicated to collecting these stories of Japanese Americans. And, in my estimation, a lot of it is about education. If we're just more educated on these topics, then we have less bias, even though we all obviously have bias. But I'm just wondering to what degree someone like Tom Ikeda in Seattle has affected, a greater consciousness about Japanese Americans.
Oh, I think he has. I mean, the work he's done there over 25 years and the resource he has compiled there, those are going to serve people like me, historians, educators, for many, many decades to come. It's such a trove of personal stories. I think what Tom's done, and really what I'm trying to do with the book too, in a more limited way, is to sort of personalize that part of history. Yes, we all know that this happened, but what were their lives? What were the lived experiences of these people? Because ultimately they're all individuals. They all have unique circumstances. What I'm trying to do in the book is the same thing Tom's trying to do with Densho, I think, which is to let readers, whether of Japanese ancestry or not, get to know some of these people on a deeply personal level. And so I think, my feeling is that if you get to know, for young men, for instance, and their families, their mothers and their sisters and their aunties, if you get to know them and what they went through as immigrants and then what they went through in these camps and what they went through in the war, it begins to build appreciation for what collectively Japanese Americans and Asian Americans have done for this country, literally laying down their lives in many cases for this country. And so that's my hope for the book, is just that it will help personalize that slice of history.
And as you personalize it, you also in your book really share the nuance and the discrepancy of that experience for Japanese Americans from the mainland, from California, and from Hawaii. And having just experienced Hawaii recently, I can definitely attest personally of the unique culture and the diversity and the language idiosyncrasies and uniqueness there.
Tell us a little bit about what you were hoping to achieve and how that difference really stood out for you.
Yeah, so the difference between the mainland Nisei second generation Americans and the guys from Hawaii was very, very stark. You know, the kids from Hawaii, I call them kids, these young men from Hawaii, many of them grew up on sugarcane or pineapple plantations in Hawaii, which is a very brutal kind of working conditions, a very racially stratified society, although very multicultural overall. Those young men, they grew up speaking almost entirely Pidgin English, the Hawaiian Creole, and developing sort of a kind of hang loose kind of attitude towards life that we associate with Hawaii. The young men from the mainland, for the most part, some of them grew up on farms in, you know, along the West Coast. A lot of them, though, with pretty ordinary middle-class American lives, their families owned flower shops or laundries or some small business or another. A lot of them were students at, you know, Cal Berkeley or UCLA or someplace like that. They were, you know, more typical of what you think of as mainstream middle-class Americans in the early 1940s. But when those two groups, they were brought, the young men that volunteered for the service came together at basic training, which was in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. It was like trying to mix oil and water. The two groups did not understand each other at all. I mean, literally didn't understand each other. The mainland guys could not understand what the Hawaiians were saying because the Hawaiians always wanted to speak Pidgin, and it was incomprehensible to the mainlanders. And so the Hawaiian guys got angry because they felt like they were being disrespected. The whole mainland guys got angry because they couldn't make themselves understood. So fistfights broke out all over Camp Shelby within days of their bringing these two groups together. And that went on for quite a while. There was just, so there were so many cultural differences between the mainland guys and the Hawaii guys that that it took a long time to work out. One of the sources of friction was the guys from Hawaii didn't really realize that these concentration camps even existed on the mainland. They're by and large in Hawaii, Japanese Americans weren't incarcerated except for some first generation folks. So the young men from Hawaii arrived at these camps, and they ran into all these young men whose families were in the camps. And they didn't understand it until finally the Army put them on buses and took them to, there were two camps in Arkansas nearby, took them to these camps. These young men saw for themselves all these men, women, and children behind barbed wire, and they began to understand what the mainland young men were experiencing and going through. And that started the process of sort of bringing them together.
And it also brought them together with their experience in the military. And, you know, again, you're showing this patriotism and the light facing this mountain from home, but then also when they get in the military, now these two groups with very different cultures and very different experiences are coming. And in a sense, you know, I read one of the quotes from the general there that they were just fodder. They were just, you know, tool pieces to easily be destroyed or lost in battles. And they're having this common experience and still pursuing and still being determined to win those battles. And so the resilience there.
Yeah, and they were extremely resilient. These were pretty tough young men. You know, once, as I say, there was a lot of friction among them originally that got partly healed while they were in basic training. But it got healed real quickly once they were in battle. You know, they really looked out for one another like a band of brothers. They did have this common, unique sort of identity as Japanese American soldiers. And so they cohered very well once they got into the war. As the war does that to a fighting unit, you know, you wind up, you are responsible for the life of the guy on either side of you in many ways. And so they became extremely close. Also, they became an extremely effective fighting force. They wound up being one of the most, if not the most decorated military units of its size In American military history, they won an incredible number of medals and honors during the course of the war, and were widely admired within the military for their courage and their ability on the battlefield.
Well, as you say, Daniel, it's all about the stories, and you've told a great story here. The book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. Might I mention that this is what my father is getting for Father's Day, which is, you know, sort of right around the corner. So it's good timing there. He's going to love this book. Thank you so much for joining us again on The Mountain Life. We did speak with you years ago with Boys in the Boat, and we hope you'll come back to Park City, and best of luck to you. It's been great having you.
I'd love to. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Life.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.